Let's get busy tonight from studies in John, and I would title this tonight, The Spring of Living Water, and of course we know we're talking about Jesus and his encounter with the woman at the well. Commentators tend, before we read any text, let me sort of set the scene. We don't really need to go over how this incident happens, and last week I think the pre-work of Samaritans and Jews was laid out the way I wanted to lay it out. At least I hope it helped to sort of set the stage a little better. I don't want to review all of that and go back over why this is such an amazing encounter, but I do want to make mention of the fact that when you study this with commentary, most commentators focus in the woman at the well on Jesus bringing up her sin. I couldn't get away from that, and almost every commentator wanted to really focus on, look at how Jesus brings up her five men she's living with. Is she married to? Was she married to them? Was she not? We don't know. Based on the Greek word, husband and men are the same word. So she could have been five men, five husbands, living with five people concurrently, same time. Who knows? But commentators are obsessed with the sin part, and they're obsessed with the fact that Jesus brings it up. So almost every commentator I would read would talk about how Jesus confronts her sin. Jesus exposes her sin. And I know where they're going with it, because you know, that's the setup for like, this is proper exegetical New Testament ministry. Watch how Jesus does it. Sometimes this is how you've got to do it. And who am I? What do I know? But I think they missed the point. The confrontation with the woman at the well is... Let me just say, I vehemently disagree that Jesus is confronting the woman about her sin. No, Jesus is confronting her emptiness and her loneliness, and he shows her why she's empty and lonely. We're going at it backwards if we think this is a confrontation with sin. This is a confrontation with chaos. This is Jesus staring into her void and giving her meaning and showing her how to move on. It's not condemning. It's not accusatory. It's not judgmental. It's with open arms. It's voluntary. At worst, he gets her to face her reality. At best, he gives her a reason why she's in that reality. And I just think we're tripping before we ever get started if we go into this lesson, this chapter, convinced that we have found a moment of Jesus exposing sin in someone, and we glaze right past the fact of how the confrontation begins in the first place and why it ever takes place. And that, to me, is worth studying. And so, just disclaimer, I won't tonight steer this, although we will end at her sin. I'm not steering this towards how you should deal with people and expose their failure. I want to steer this towards what I think is a legitimate confrontation on the part of Jesus with the emptiness and the chaos and the void that so many people bring to the Lord. And maybe they don't even realize how empty they are. And maybe we can help with that in someone's life as well. So let's read some text. John chapter 4. And let's begin in verse number 6. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well, and it was about the sixth hour. It's an important piece of information in that text we'll bring out in a moment. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink," for his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. Then the woman of Samaria said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman, for Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." A couple things I want you to see right out of the gate about this passage. Jesus is tired. Jesus asked for help. These are simple. There's nothing brainy here. But man, we fly right past this in our quest for the divine Jesus. We miss the human Jesus. And in our quest for the divine and overlooking the human, it's easy to overlook stuff like Jesus was tired. And go, why was he tired? Well, he was human. He was tired. But Jesus is exhausted to the point that he takes a break, middle of the day, Samaritan city, speaking to a woman unmarried. We could go through the whole list, the litany of things that is socially or religiously unacceptable about what he is doing. And yet he feels like ministry is rest. And that strikes me as being one of the most important aspects of this lesson, because he's going to feed as he feeds her. And there's something to be said for finding your way through ministry, even in exhaustion, viewing ministry as rest. But then also, Jesus asks for help. And I'm struck by the fact that most of us only seek help upward. We don't seek help downward. So if you think you need help in an area, you go find someone smarter than you, or wealthier than you, or more plugged in than you. You don't go down the social ladder to get help. So you don't say, boy, I need some help. I could use some financial assistance. I think I'll go down to the street corner to the guy holding the cardboard sign and see if he can slip me some money. You know, that doesn't make any sense. You're barking up the wrong tree. Or that's a stupid example. I know. I'm overdoing it. So let's be less obvious. We don't go to people who we think should be looking up to us for advice. That one works. Okay? We go to people whom we do look up to, or who it's socially acceptable to look up to. They're older than us, they're more experienced than us, they've been around the block a time or two, and we think, well, they won't look down on me for asking for help, but we're not going to go down to ask for help. If we ever need to learn anything about our Lord in this passage, learn that he gets tired, and when he gets tired, he figures the best way to get out of being tired is maybe to rest in his Father and see what Dad would have him do. There's a good place to start. And then we also learn that Jesus wasn't so lofty in his own identity that he was incapable of asking for help from somebody beneath his station. He asks for help from a woman who's a Samaritan, whom he doesn't know. And all three of those are socially unacceptable. And he does it. And he doesn't flaunt it, but John 4 kind of flaunts it for him. I mean, we're talking about it 2,000 years later, of the man who takes time out to go down the social ladder for advice. If it tells me anything, it's maybe recognize your own place in the world and steer yourself with some humility. Because there may be somebody in your circle who can help you, whom doesn't qualify to help you by the metrics of the world. So listen, you know, there you might have an opportunity to learn something from someone, forgive the description, I don't have a better one, from someone who is your inferior. Okay? Maybe they're not. Of course, they're not your inferior in the eyes of God, but in the social stratus, they're your inferior. And you say, I can't learn anything from them. Or if I do, I'll look weak, or I'll look ignorant. And I'm always impressed by how Jesus never worries about looking weak. He has this on me, and he has it on most of us. He never worries about his perception. He's frequently takes help from people whom nobody else would take help from, eats with those whom nobody else would bother to eat with, and loves on those whom nobody else would touch. I mean, I'm always blown away by Jesus touching lepers. One Wikipedia search of leprosy, you'll find out you're not supposed to do that. You don't have to be a doctor to realize this airborne illness of which you don't make skin-to-skin contact, and yet Jesus seems like he goes out of his way hugging lepers. Like, get in here, because... And I wondered for so long, why is he doing this? Is he showing off? Or maybe he knows that if you're a leper, you haven't touched another human being in so long, and there's nothing like human contact, and so he gives you what you need more than you even need healed. So he just touches you. That's special. So he's got this on all of us, honestly. I mean, who are we? But he never seems to worry about his reputation. He never seems to worry about if he's moving the wrong way down the social ladder. He doesn't worry about populating his little inner circle with wealthy men and men of fame and men of influence and men of power. In fact, when he gets around men of power, he tends to close his mouth, not because he's intimidated or ashamed, but because it's as if he knows his kingdom has no room for them. So what are you going to do with a Pilate in the kingdom of God? You're much better off with a Peter. and an Andrew and a Philip. You're much better off with a bunch of fishermen who are finding their way than a guy who figures he's already got it figured out. In fact, that's the core tenet of the kingdom. Last will be first, first will be last. You guys think you'll be great, you'll be least. Welcome to my kingdom. I just ministered on that Sunday in Springfield. We're in Luke 22, where Jesus has two disciples arguing, which one of us gets to be the best? So this real immature, childish argument going on in the background at the Last Supper. You know, Da Vinci didn't write about that. He didn't paint about that. You know, you don't see two guys over here, you know, casting lots to be right-hand man of Jesus. And Jesus says, I confer upon you a kingdom. He says, in my kingdom, the man at the table, there's a man at the table and there's a man that's serving. The man that's greater is the man at the table, and the man that's lesser is the man that's serving. In my kingdom, I'm the man that's serving tables. He goes, you sure you want to be a part of my kingdom? That's Jesus at the woman at the well. That's the best way I know how to describe him. He's here. He doesn't just talk the kingdom. He walks the kingdom. He lives the kingdom. Don't be afraid to take a break. Don't be afraid to rest in the midst of your efforts. It's the antithesis of the modern business model. Take a break. He takes a break in the middle of the day. He goes, I'm going to take a break from my labors. I'm going to ask for help from someone that should not be able to give me help. And I really do think that that could be the whole lesson tonight. Like, you could frame the entire thought around, hey, you want to apply something? Go out in your life this week and find an opportunity to rest and learn something from someone you think is less than you. And it would be a good mission for all of us. And you go, what might I learn if I wasn't always trying to learn upward? And of course, we want to orient ourselves higher. It's who we are as humans. But watch the Jesus model. It's powerfully impressive how he handles himself. Go to 10. Here's what I want to do. I want to read out through about 18. And we're not going to stop at each word, and some we'll give more attention to than others. So we're going to read out, then come back, and then read out again. I don't think we'll get past 18. This takes you right up to the you've had five husbands passage. So let's do some work on these and then come back. Jesus answered and said to her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, give me a drink, you should have asked him and he would have given you living water. And the woman, we'll come back to 10 in a moment. The woman said to him, sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get that living water? Notice she's in the physical. There's no doubt when you read the 11th verse that she is pretty sure that Jesus is talking about real water. Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well, who drank from it himself, as well as his sons and his livestock? And Jesus answered and said to her, whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. Whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never thirst. He's trying to take her spiritual. This is becoming more obvious. Never thirst again, but the water that I will give him will become in him a fountain of water, springing up into everlasting life. The woman said to him, sir, give me this water that I may not thirst nor come here to draw. And Jesus said to her, go call your husband and come here. And the woman answered and said, I have no husband. And Jesus said to her, you have well said, I have no husband, for you've had five husbands. The one whom you now have is not your husband, and that you spoke truly. Okay, go back to 10. We're gonna get to 18 tonight as we work, but I want to slow down a little bit and try to show why Jesus is doing what he's doing in this passage. Jesus answered and said to her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that says to you. So there's the gift and the giver. In fact, just did a message a few weeks ago called The Gift and the Giver, where this was my passage. It was at my brother's home in California. We're doing a little living room meeting with some of his friends. This was the scripture that was on my heart that week. And so I don't want to reteach that, but I remember so strongly that week being struck with the idea of both the gift and the giver, that Jesus says to her, if you only knew. And so I kind of approached that with this thought. There were two things she needed to know, neither of which she knew. Had she known them, life would have been different. How much different would it be for all of us if we understood both the gift and the giver? If we understood both what is being offered and who is offering. And just as the Old Testament says, my people perish for lack of knowledge, I think people still perish for lack of knowledge because they don't know the gift and they don't know the giver. And while many people are still trying to figure out if there's a God and prove whether he is God or not, we run right past the gift and right past the gift of his son and the giver of that gift. And so I think that's the point that Jesus is making. If you knew the gift and the giver, or who it is that says to you, "Give me a drink," you would have asked him, he would have given you living water. There's a double meaning if you're a Jew who has walked through the Old Testament, of which most of them had. I don't know how familiar they are. I always run into this problem when I'm studying, and I'm trying to put myself in the mindset of a first century person, and that's hard to do anyhow, but I always struggle with how much did they really know, because I don't even know how much the average person on Sunday really knows, and I've been doing this my whole life, and I've been in pulpit ministry for almost 26 years, and I'm still amazed at how little people know. And I don't mean that as an insult, like, oh, I got so much knowledge. I'm talking like Bible characters, you know, like basic elementary stuff. And so I a lot of times I think, wow, I thought everybody knew that, and I'm getting questioned on the ABCs later. And so that makes me think, well, maybe, I mean, we got access to all kinds of info. You on your phone is a, you know, that's a supercomputer that you can learn anything you want to learn on that. And maybe we're not doing it justice, you know, maybe 7 straight hours of Netflix isn't the best way to utilize the technology when you could literally learn Japanese with this almost the same amount of effort. Just takes time to do. And so that, you know, short of a soapbox, I mean, that's all I'll say about that. And I think that, so I'm always amazed. I go, well, I don't know how much people know. They should know at least the basics. So I try to think, well, how much did somebody know in Jesus's day? They don't have a supercomputer in there. They don't even have a copy of the Torah at their house. They go to the synagogue and hear it sang out loud and spoken out loud, and they probably can't even read it themselves. If you were to hand them a copy, they don't necessarily have the ability to read it. Their tradition's very oral, okay? Ours is very written, the written word. Theirs is very oral, much passed down. You listen to grandpa, you listen to dad, you listen to the rabbi. You talk in the streets, the marketplace. The Greek culture was very very much an auditory learning culture, and it had been for 500 years. I mean, you've had all these great Greek philosophers standing on the street corners proclaiming things, and people listened. And it is a scientific or psychological fact, is probably the better way to say it, that how we grow to learn, we get better at how it is presented to us. So you and I in our culture are very visual learners. We forget almost everything we hear. We remember more if we read it. We remember even more if we write it down. Their culture couldn't read or write, but they forgot almost nothing they heard. Why? Well, because that's the only way they knew to do it. You adjust, in other words, to how you learn to do it. So I want to give her the benefit of the doubt. I said all of that for this reason. I want to give her the benefit of the doubt. I think she knew more than what we might assume the average person knows. This is why, and I probably should have said this early in the John series, because I do this every week. Every week I'm going, here's what a Jew would have known based on the Old Testament. And I get struck as I go back and listen to these and go, would they have known that? I don't know. I mean, most of us don't know that. We have access to the same material. But I give them the benefit of the doubt, being auditory learners, and I think having it repeated over and over and over, and having it be, we're very secular, our society, even in Christianity, let's just admit it. We're a very secular-based society who has Christianity as part of our existence. They were a very sacred society pushing against secularism, okay? And so the very foundation of their knowledge would have been sacred. The very foundation of our knowledge is secular. I'm not cutting us down. It is what it is. But we're also Gentile. They were Jewish. She's Samaritan, so she has that underpinning of Judaism. She might have known stuff like Genesis 26:19. Isaac, I'm doing this because I want to show you what she thinks when Jesus says, "I'm going to give you living water." Okay, Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found a well of running water there. That phrase, as inconspicuous as it looks in Genesis, is the very heartbeat of what the Torah will describe as living water. When you see a New Testament phrase like living water, the Hebrew vernacular for that would have been water that moves. Okay, well, what's water that moves? Water can't walk. It can't jump up and down. So water that moves is running water. I remember when I was a kid, there was a real debate over water baptism in the churches I was in. And the debate was, shouldn't the water be living if you're going to get baptized in it? Well, as a little kid, I'm thinking, that's weird because water isn't alive. And I had to have my own little, you know, theological lesson of, no, living water is running water. You can't baptize in a baptistry because that water's not going anywhere. You have to baptize in a river because that water is going somewhere. That is dead water versus living water. How many of you realize they might have missed the point? Just a maybe. But if you're taking it literal, then yes, they're right. It had to be running water. This is what Jesus is talking about when he says living water. At least that's what I think she thinks he's talking about. Okay? Again, benefit of the doubt. What does she know? Probably more than we do. That's kind of where I'm landing on that. If my question is, what does she know? Okay, probably more than me. Probably more than you. What she gets instantly is, he's going to give me living water. Well, that has something to do with water that moves. That sounds very much like Isaac's well. She's sitting at Jacob's well. If you know genealogy at all, that's in the family. And she goes, okay, that's the source of what we have. God gave us running water. Or this. Here's another one from the Torah. Leviticus 14:6. As for the living bird, and we're jumping midstream, pardon the pun, on this. You caught that. Midstream on this sacrifice, but you'll get it. As for the living bird, take it, the cedar wood and the scarlet and the hyssop, and dip them and the living bird in the blood of the bird that was killed over the running water. Boy, that would be, PETA would have a fit over that. So again, aside from the fact that you killed a bird, you took the living bird and dipped it in the blood of the dead bird. I mean, this is rough, but I wanted you to see all that. I really honestly forgot that verse was so violent, but I remember to the very end is what I want you to see. The blood of the bird that was killed over what? Running water. And so there again, the Hebrew idea is that the water is running or the water is moving. And this might be what is in her mind whenever she hears Jesus refer to, I will give you living water. And so for her, that means this is a water that moves. But there is a double meaning to living water in the Old Testament. That's one. That's the thought of life-giving. But there's also God as the source of your life. Here's probably the Old Testament's most famous moment for this. Jeremiah 2:13. God's talking, and he says, my people have committed two evils. Number one, they have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters. And there's the phrase that is different than running water, Genesis 26, running water, Leviticus 14. This is living water, double meaning, because this is metaphorical. We're not at Isaac's well, and we're not dipping a bird in water. But we know Jesus isn't water, I'm ahead of myself. God, not Jesus. God isn't saying, I'm water. No, they've forsaken me, the fountain of this metaphorical. What's the second problem? They've hewn themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. Don't think of a cistern like a pot. If you do, then you're missing the point of the metaphor and you're misappropriating the metaphor because that would be portable. That's not what God's talking about. This is not trying to carry the presence of God. A cistern was, in this sense, a reservoir. That did not contain running water. It contained dead water, to use my own term. And it was handmade, most of the time out of stone, mortar to hold the stone together. And because of the lack of technological engineering, it's not going to hold water very well. It's also going to pick up the qualities of whatever holds it. So if it's a concrete wouldn't be right. If it's stone, let's say it that way, and it's covered in pitch or mud or dried clay, mortar of some sort, whatever the water touches, it picks up the quality of that mortar. So if it's going to get dirty fast, and so there's a lot of cleaning that had to come from water that was held in cisterns. God says you've really done two things wrong. First of all, you've forsaken me. I'm the fountain of living water. I literally provide for you life. This is God's way, if I can say that. I think we can. If this is God's way of referencing his own ability to bring water out of the rock, say in the Old Testament where Israel goes into the wilderness and they complain because they're thirsty, and God says to Moses, smite the rock. So Moses hits the rock and water comes out. Moses is blown away. Israel's not as impressed as Moses is, because Israel only sees the water. Moses sees the cleft. It's a good thought there. Consider that in Psalms, David says, Moses knew God's ways, Israel knew God's acts. Maybe what that is saying is that Israel knew what God acted like, but Moses knew why God acted that way. So Israel saw water, Moses saw God hit a rock. What's more impressive? Seeing God hit a rock. I mean, water's water, but Moses was sold. Moses is so sold because he's the guy that sees where it comes from. You could also say I'm on a tangent here. I'm just kind of chasing a rabbit. So let me get him. You could say that the Old Testament is in some ways is a reflection. Some parts are a reflection of how Israel saw God's acts, and some parts are a reflection of how Moses saw God's ways. And there's a difference. And I think maybe that comes out sometime in the story. That's a side thought. That's me trying to answer a question before it's asked. Head a question off before it gets asked. Yeah, okay. I'm kind of thinking there. I like that. So the first thing, they forsook the fountain of living water. It's metaphorical. But they've hewn cisterns, but they're not just cisterns. They're cisterns that are broken that can hold no water, because that's the nature of cisterns. This is not an unusual cistern. It's not as if you guys aren't very good at it, and so it's broken. No, the nature of cisterns were they're temporary. They don't last very long. And they pick up the nature of whatever you put in them. And so God is saying to Israel, I am pure. I am living. I can bring water out of your rock. But you've chosen to go a different way. One scholar I read after said there was an innumerable number of cisterns have been unearthed, archaeological digs have unearthed. They used the word innumerable. I thought that was possibly a stretch, but maybe not. Maybe we're finding these piles of rocks all the time underground in Galilee going, what was that for? They go, well, that's probably a cistern, a reservoir, because you don't have running water and you don't have a way to keep this stuff. And so you're building cisterns every day to try to store water, and then you got to boil it and clean it up. And God, way back in Jeremiah, is going, in the realm of the spirit, you forsook me, the guy that could bring you everything from the inside, and you've went out trying to collect it from everywhere else. And it's not coincidental that Jesus drops this on this woman, because what has she been doing with her life? We don't know yet. We're cheating because we're sneaking ahead. But he knows, and she knows, that she's dug out cisterns over and over and over again to provide for her own security. And they're all broken. And he's going to identify them in a minute as five men. And he's not throwing a stone at her. He's trying to show her the problem with the faultiness of her trying to fill the void. And maybe she's trying to fill the void with affection, or she's trying to fill the void with security, or maybe she sold herself to these men, or maybe she just has no self-value or no self-worth. We don't know, and we don't ever get to the bottom of that story. And maybe that's the point too, is that we don't get to the bottom of it because we don't need to. We don't need to know why everybody else has broken cisterns, but we all have a few things that we've put our confidence in that just don't work. And we put our confidence in our youth, and that didn't last very long. Or we put our confidence in our looks, and that lasted didn't even last as long as our youth sometime. Or we put our confidence in our money, or we put our confidence in our career, or we put our confidence in our brains, or our brawn, or our humor, or our family, or our job, or whatever. And they don't work because they're cisterns that don't bring life out of themselves. That's the difference. It's not that they're bad. But Jesus comes to offer a better way. Again, metaphorically, he's saying, I am a way in which something can spring out. I think it's this, that the source of life outside the life of God is it's a broken cistern. Let me show you some of my own thoughts and notes. She knows the analogy. I think she does. I spent too much time tonight trying to establish it. Does she know the analogy? I think she knows the analogy. And Jesus uses it to show her that her attempts at fulfillment are broken. So a couple thoughts. Pursuit of happiness is often a broken cistern. You might be surprised how long I sit and look at these sometimes when I'm writing notes down. And sometimes you might be surprised how little I sit and look at them, but moments like this, you might be surprised how long I sit and stare at it and think and ponder over it, because I try to be more than just, as much as I chase rabbits and sometimes fly by the seat of my pants, I really do try to fancy myself at least to have thought out where I'm going to go before I get there, so to think. And so in doing that, when I write down outlines or notes, I think long and hard about statements, especially ones of which I don't put a verse up there with. So it's really just me saying to you, hey, here's what I think. And I think we're in a culture that pursues happiness as the highest end goal. And we do it in some ways based upon the civic religion of our country. I think we have a spiritual religion in our country and we have a civic religion. Our civic religion's politics, and our Bible's the Constitution, and our baptismal certificate's the Declaration of Independence. That's our civic religion. Our civic God is the red, white, and blue, and the Trinity is the red, white, and blue, and the bald eagle, and U.S. military. Baseball. So we got the civic religion, and we root it in written document. That's not surprising. So for people that think, well, the Bible's stupid, why do people trust an old book? And yet, every day, you're swamped with, the Constitution says. I go, don't you realize you are a person who's founded your principles on written documents? You've done it. We've done it our entire existence. Since we figured out we could scratch on cave walls, we started basing our civil governments on written documents. And so there's no shocker to me that the Bible means so much to us as it should. It's also no shocker to me that we have a civil religion and its Bible is what it is. Well, one of those unalienable rights endowed upon us by our Creator is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which Thomas Jefferson regretted writing The Pursuit of Happiness because he had picked the line from other writings in which it was life, liberty, and property. Well, it's not as poetic, for one, to say unalienable rights are life, liberty, and property. We really need this civics lesson right now in the middle of a Bible study. I know. So I'm going to finish anyway. I'm already in it. So I'm going to finish. So it goes, life, liberty, property. The Constitution fixed it, by the way, in the Bill of Rights. So there we go. But the point being, Jefferson would have sold it as a collective pursuit of happiness, not an individual pursuit of happiness, because an individual pursuit of happiness could be fool's gold. So if you pursue individual happiness, you might end up broken and lost and an alcoholic, and in our day, a drug addict, and nobody wants to be around you, and boy, you're happy. You know, go for that. And so it was really more of a civic corporate happiness. But let me back to my original statement. the pursuit of happiness has sort of become the end game. It's how we raise our kids.
Well, I just want you to be happy.
Which is actually the worst advice you can give anybody that you really love. I mean, because if you really love somebody, you don't want them to just be happy. You want them to have a life full of meaning. And if having a life full of meaning brings them happiness, bonus. But if you have happiness and no meaning, you could be chasing something that's bad for you or that kills you, or it certainly isn't worth laying your life down for to be happy. If you had meaning, you'd have purpose. And if you had purpose, you'd have a reason to throw your feet on the floor. And chasing a life of happiness isn't the end game. And if we end up there, great, awesome, wonderful. But I think our culture has hewn out broken cisterns called happiness. Because happiness gets a really pretty clear-cut definition. It's like, I want to make this much, and I want to marry this kind of person, and I want to live in this kind of house, and I want to drive that kind of car, and I want to have that kind of job, and I want to live on this side of town. And if I could get all of that stuff, I'd be happy. And all of us know better, because we all tell that person, well, none of that stuff will make you happy. And yet, we're the ones that told them, go out, I just want you to be happy. Well, what's that mean? I want you to go get all the stuff you want. Well, I thought you said none of that makes me happy. No, well, it doesn't make them happy, but honey, it'll make you happy. And I don't think we realize sometimes what we're replacing, and it's been there all along. Christ says to the woman, I could give you something you don't have. You've had five husbands, and you're looking for something you can't find. You keep coming back to a well every day. You think I'm talking about a real well. You and I aren't on the same page yet. You think I'm talking about real water. You keep coming back here because you're thirsty. I want to give you water. You don't have to come back again and receive. And I don't mean real water. I mean living water from the inside out. And so I think pursuit of happiness is often a broken cistern. I don't mean happiness is not a great thing, and I don't want it, and I don't wish it on you, but not at the expense of meaning and purpose. Why can't some people find happiness? I think maybe we're putting the cart before the horse. So why can't you find happiness? Well, maybe happiness is supposed to be the end result of a life spent with something to do instead of just a life spent. And so you need something to do and a reason to do it. And how many of you realize if you have a reason, something to do and a reason to do it, none of the other stuff in life matters anymore? That's when the other stuff starts to mean less. I don't have to have that anymore. Why? Because I do what I love, and I love what I do, and I have a reason to breathe and a reason to get out of bed in the morning. And it's not to get to Friday to get a check. And it's the check's great. The check's kind of like the happiness if, you know, well, you'd quit if they didn't give you a check. But in some cases, in some things, I'm not even talking about a job. I'm talking about that which brings you meaning. And you wouldn't quit that even if they didn't give you a check. So I get to do what brings me meaning. And some weeks, there's hardly a check. You know, you keep doing what you, where the source of your life is. And if you haven't found that, and I'm talking to a lot of people out there, then that's how you should spend the rest of your life. Is finding it. And start by meeting the fountain of living water. Because that's what Jesus tries to get her to do. Like, aren't you tired of the other stuff? I could give you water you wouldn't have to drink. So start by finding your rest in who he is and letting him become your life. Man, I've slowed way down. You probably already peeked ahead and saw my other little gem of wisdom. Ignorance is a hindrance to understanding. I sat and looked at this for a long time because I believe it. And I wanted to bring it out right using this story. Ignorance is a hindrance to understanding, but it's not a hindrance to his compassion. What I mean by that is she's ignorant. She's not stupid, but there's a lot she doesn't know. She doesn't know the gift or the giver. And because she doesn't know the gift or the giver, she doesn't understand that he's sitting in front of her, and man, her life could change forever right now, and she doesn't get that. And I've seen a lot of people that because of their ignorance of both the gift and the giver, they don't have understanding of the love of God, they don't have understanding of their own identity. I walk into places all the time, and this is the number one thing, is they don't know who they are, and
And so because they don't know who they are, they don't know what they have. And because they don't know what they have, they don't know what they're doing. And because they don't know what they're doing, they don't know where they're going. And because they don't know where they're going, they're miserable. Do you see where this is going? And you got to deal with that. And you got to deal with half of it in reverse, because all they do is walk up to you, talk about where they're going. And I get destination questions from people all the time that don't know themselves. I'm getting destination questions from you. You don't even know who you are. I mean, we have no relationship, but we're fighting evil every day. I was in Albuquerque a couple weeks ago, and I ministered on the Lord's Prayer backwards. I think if you really want to see what's wrong with us, look at the Lord's Prayer backwards. What's the last line of the Lord's Prayer? Deliver us from evil. How did most of us meet the Lord? Deliver me from evil. What's the first line of the Lord's Prayer? Our Father. What's the last thing most of us learn? Our Father. Why? Because you came in backwards. Because you're running from evil from the day you met God. And you don't ever meet Him as Father until right before you die, or maybe when you get to heaven. And it's such a waste. And I'm trying to walk people from both. They're backwards Christianity. I called the sermon Backdoor Christianity, because we've snuck in through the back door, and it takes us a lifetime to meet the Father, and all we do is talk about sin. Why are we talking about sin all the time? That's the same commentators that think John 4 is Jesus exposing sin. They go, no, it's not. It's Jesus looking at your void and going, here's your problem. Your sin's the last thing we'll get to. I want to talk to you first and foremost about what you could have and who you are. And we won't get to this till next week, but she pushes back against it with religion. Because she goes, well, you guys say we ought to worship in that mountain, and we think we ought to worship, which is so bizarre and off the wall and an attempt at spiritualism that is absurd. But there's something Jesus does with that. But our ignorance stops our understanding, but it doesn't stop Him from loving us. And it doesn't stop Him from being good to us. And it doesn't stop His compassion. And so that causes me to slow down in those meetings and go, oh. Before you get up here and get all ticked off at what people haven't learned, and you're going to start chucking a sledgehammer in at everybody's religion, because that's easy to do. How many of you know it's fun and easy to knock an old house down? And it's slow and hard, and you got to know what you're doing to build a new one. And it's easy to get in the pulpit and swing a sledgehammer, and it's boring to swing a framing hammer. And when I came into grace, I had a lot of fun, because I went after everything I disagreed with and everything I used to believe. And you could mock it, and you could make fun of it, and you could just beat the house down with a sledgehammer. And then you realize that sledgehammers kill people. You know, it's hard to kill a guy with a framing hammer, but it's easy to hurt somebody badly with a sledgehammer. Just keep swinging it indeterminately. And so you got to slow down then and go, okay, ignorance is not a hindrance to His compassion. So slow down. Remember, you got two ears and one mouth. Start listening twice as much as you talk. Pay attention. Learn something from people you think can't teach you anything. These are all good John 4 lessons. Listen up, because they got something to tell you. And if you don't hear them, you'll never learn from them. And if you don't learn from them, what in the world are you doing in their life? And what are you doing trying to speak into their life? What right do we have? All right, John 4:10. Jesus answered and said to her, I know we've read this twice. We're going to read it three times. If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, give me a drink, you would have asked Him and He would have given you living water. I want to focus for a moment on the word gift. My next screen, I think. I even got it there in the Greek. Doria. Doria means literally gift, or that which has been gifted to you. I wanted you to see something here. Token usage in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. This is the only place, well, John's the only place where this shows up. Matthew, Mark, Luke never talk about doria, the gift, and you would think that would be a common theme. And the only reason you would think that, remember what I told you way back, like lesson two or three, I don't know, maybe even the opening night. John, I think John is post-Paul. Post AD 70, and I told you that you will find ribbons of Paul. Remember this statement I made? There'll be a little ribbon of Paul snaking its way through the book of John that without Paul you wouldn't catch, but with Paul you're going to think it's just common in the days of Jesus, because I think John is writing what he writes as a result of having heard Paul's gospel, and here's one of those ribbons. No other gospel speaks of the doureia. Paul's influence is evident in the book of John because Paul had mastered the usage of doureia. And his disciple, Luke, let's make sure we know that. Not insulting anyone's intelligence, by the way, but I do know that in Bible study, sometimes you got to just slow down, say stuff you think everybody knows. So I'm going to slow down, say something I think everybody probably knows, but if you don't, here's a little nugget for you. Luke is a student of the Apostle Paul. He travels with Paul midstream through the book of Acts. It starts going from Paul did to we did, right smack dab in the middle of Acts. And the reason for that is that Luke is telling a story he was not a part of. And then once he's a part of it, he starts throwing in we. And so he says things and does things about Paul that no other writer does. And it's interesting that in the book of Acts, Luke, who's writing it down, starts using the word doureia. Where does he get it? Well, I think he gets it from his mentor. Paul says this, Romans 5:17. Watch this. If by one man's offense death reigned through the one, much more. We all know this verse. Much more those who receive abundance of grace and of the doureia, the gift, that which has been gifted to you, is righteousness and it reigns in life through the one Jesus Christ. Paul, I don't want to say makes that word up, but Paul decides to use it. Nobody else is using it. Paul views what's been given to you by Christ as a gift. When John retells the Jesus story in the gospel, lo and behold, he uses a Pauline phrase, and he has it coming out of the lips of Jesus. So I think here's evidence to me of the infiltration of Paul's version of the gospel into the book of John. Here's a couple more. Look at this one. 2 Corinthians 9:15. Thanks be to God for his indescribable gift. That's doureia. By the way, 2 Corinthians 9, this is the last verse of 2 Corinthians 9. How many of you know what 2 Corinthians 9 is about? Just off the top of your head. Anybody? It's a giving chapter. It's where Paul decides to tell you how you should give, not of compulsion, not of necessity, but of your heart. God loves a cheerful giver, and then churches take up offerings, and everybody laughs, you know, and it's fake because they're not really excited, but they're told to be excited, so they are excited, and they all cheer because they're really pumped to give their tithe, and they have to sort of amp themselves up in order to give. So I encourage you to go reread the 9th chapter of 2 Corinthians, and you'll find none of that falsehood. You'll find Paul going, if it blesses you, you should give. And if you can't give and love it, don't give at all. And he says, you know, you make it possible for us to keep doing what we're doing. And then he gets to the end and he goes, I thank God for the indescribable gift. And I honestly think Paul is saying, I thank God for the indescribable gifting of your money into our ministry. And he goes, it's indescribable how God has gifted me and gifted you, and your abundance makes up for our lack. And when we are of abundance, we make up for your lack. And he calls that an indescribable gift. One more, Ephesians 4:7. But to each one of us, grace was given according to the measure of Christ's doureia. Paul steps it up a level and says the gift is Christ's gift to you. And it is what? Grace. And it is the gift. You could even say it's not just that grace is the gift, but the gift is Christ. Either way, what we have seen is Paul's version of the epistle, of the gospel. I think being filtered through the writing of John out of the lips of Jesus. Don't take that to mean Jesus didn't say it. Take it to mean that John, with a fresh revelation of how Paul says it, recalls incidents in the life and ministry of Jesus. And as John retells it, that's how he hears Jesus telling it. But it's interesting to me that Matthew, Mark, Luke don't hear Jesus saying it that way. Well, they don't even have the John 4 story. But that's just another example of how that sort of comes through Jesus. All right, John 4, let's do 15, 16, 17, 18. And we'll bring it home. Woman said to him, sir, give me this water that I might not thirst, nor come here to draw. She's still in the natural. Jesus said to her, go call your husband, come here. Now, why does he do this? This is where I want to end. Why does he do this? What's the point? He doesn't open with this. He doesn't say, hey, sinner, you living with five guys you're not married to, you need to Yeah, get saved. He starts using our vernacular. You ever wondered why they don't say the stuff that we say all the time? Like, why does Jesus never say to someone, you want to get saved? Why don't any time in the New Testament doesn't the Apostle Paul like go to Ephesus and go, and I want all of you that want to get saved to bow your head and close your eyes? Raise your hand, repeat after me. And if you want to, you guys want to get saved? I know I sound like I'm making fun. Well, you know my heart. I am kind of making fun of myself because I've been there, just done all that stuff, didn't even think about it. So why doesn't Jesus do that? I don't know why he doesn't say it the way we say it, but what I do know is he doesn't open with, hey, you got five guys you've been living with. Yeah. Five divorces. I don't know if they're men or husbands. That word's ambiguous in the Greek. So it's hard to say. Does Jesus say, you have five guys you've been living with, or you have five guys you've slept with, or is he saying you have five ex-husbands? We don't know. What we do know is that she's guilty. That's evident of something. And what I think the something is she's been trying to find hope with broken cisterns. That's the whole point of the message that Jesus is saying to her. It's not working, is it? It's not working. And so I think in part, he's bringing her back to the spiritual, because she's still locked in this physical. I want some of that water. And Jesus is going, whoa, I'm going to have to step it up, because she doesn't realize I'm not talking about natural water. I'm talking about spiritual water. I think the reason he brings up the five men and the woman answers that I don't have a husband. Give me the next. Jesus said, you've well said I don't have a husband, for you have had five. The one whom you now have is not your husband. In that you have spoken truly. I think the reason that he does this is to show her spiritual emptiness, because she's still thinking she's physically thirsty. And Jesus wants you to know, no, you're not just physically thirsty. You're spiritually thirsty. The reason why you're doing a lot of what you're doing is that you're empty inside. And I'm not here to condemn you for your emptiness. I'm here to fill your emptiness. I'm not here to show you another path. I'm here to show you the only path, the one you missed. Her pushback, and this is where we'll get to next week, her pushback will be religion. And it's the pushback of almost every person you introduce to the fullness of God. She immediately goes, well, should we worship? Should we worship on that mountain? You say that? And she tries to take him off path. And Jesus will do a masterful job of pulling her back on path. What I want to do next week is I want to go off path with her. And I want to look at Mount Gerizim, the holy mountain of Samaria. And I want to show you that it's not the first time the Bible talks about it. And she definitely knows that one. We won't need to spend 10 minutes on figuring out what she knew. She knew it for sure, and it's the only reason she brings it up. And Jesus is not going to be diverted. Temporarily, he will. He'll go down that road with her for a moment and bring her back. And what a difference is going to make, because the woman's going to leave her water pot. It's the whole reason she came to the well for the water pot. She's going to leave the water pot and go back to her house. Come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Is it an exaggeration? Absolutely. He didn't tell her everything she ever did. But when you finally fill someone's emptiness, you became the whole world to them. And that's her point. And that's the book of John's point. Is it? Yes, don't get caught up in the, he didn't tell her everything. Yeah, he kind of did. He's like the guy that told me recently, you may not be able to change the world, but you changed the whole world for me. And I thought, now that's the way to say it. Because you may not do much else, honestly, but if you did a lot right there. And that's enough for all of us to find meaning and move forward. All right, let's pray. Father, I thank you for tonight and this word, and I thank you for the spring of living water and what you have shown me in this. I want to just say thank you for two things. I want to thank you for what you showed me as I was preparing this, and I want to thank you for what you showed me as I was delivering it, because you brought a lot of stuff to me tonight that that I'm thankful for and that I feel might have helped to stay true to the spirit of the story. It might have helped fill some void. And we thank you for that. Let's let that work go on. Teach us how to let that work go on. Teach us where in our lives we've got broken cisterns that we can let go of and what that looks like in Jesus' name.